This conference has allowed me to make a lot of new friends, which is one of the best things about it, to tell you the truth. It's also given me the chance to renew some friendships. Muriel Zimmerman is a person who I met when I was working in the Department of English here some years ago as assistant to the chair. Muriel headed up the writing program here at UC Santa Barbara for many years. She teaches in the writing program here. She's moderating the next panel on science writing. Muriel.
I'm going to introduce our panel, but I'm also going to introduce Casey Cole, who's not here, just because there's a point of interest. Marcia Bartuszak and is the author of Archives of the Universe, Einstein's Unfinished Symphony, Through a Universe Darkly, Thursday's Universe. She's a two-time winner of the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Award. She's a visiting lecturer in the Graduate Science Writing Program at MIT. And her undergraduate and graduate training, because this is one of our big concerns today, is what do you need to know, what do you need to be, what should what had to have happened to you to make it possible for you to write about physics and cosmology. Her degree is a BA in her degrees are a BA in communication and an MS in physics. Casey Cole is the physical science writer for the Los Angeles Times. Her books include Mind Over Matter, The Hole in the Universe, The Universe and the Teacup, and First You Build a Cloud. She is also an American Physics Society winner of the Science Writing Award, and her degree is a bachelor's degree in political science. Dennis Overby is deputy science editor of the New York Times, a collector of Einstein memorabilia. Some of you have seen the Wednesday. He's got a poster for Albert Einstein, drink a few glasses and become a genius. He's the author. That's a t-shirt. Oh, a t-shirt. I want that even more. You should have been selling them at this conference. He's the author of, recently of Einstein in Love and of Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos. I'm going to have to let him straighten out about his education. He told me that he studied physics at MIT, and I simply, it was a noisy room the other night, and I couldn't hear if he said it had hurt or it had helped. So. Sidney Perkowitz is an author of 110 refereed articles in journals like Physical Review, the author of numerous plays and performance pieces, four books, Digital People, Universal Foam, Empire of Light, and Optical Characterization of Semiconductors.
That's the ringer. That's the ringer.
It's the one that lets you, you won't be surprised to hear that he's BS, MS, and PhD in physics. And the first thing we're going to talk about as a panel is, you know, that issue of what do you need to know to write about this topic. And Marcia, I'll start with you.
Well, there a lot of people, when they find out I have this very unusual background, the bachelor's in communications, I had actually worked as a journalist and for 4 years, right out of my undergraduate days, and realized that I wanted to write on science. And the models at that time, back in the Jurassic Age, in the early 1970s, was the Isaac Asimovs and the Carl Sagans, and I somehow got it in my head that I really did need a degree. So I went back to school intending just to get a bachelor's degree, but I fell in love with physics and moved on into getting the master's degree. Has it helped or hurt? I like to say it's a double-edged sword. There are moments when I am out and about going on my travels and interviewing when I wish my sources did not know that I had a background in science, because often the scientists then will be in their teaching mode, dipping deep into their own analogies and metaphors, how they think and communicate their ideas to a wider audience. And as long as they don't know, as I'm sitting there busily taking my notes, that that I did take differential calculus or tensors, they're going to try to communicate on that level to me. As soon as they find out that I have a physics background, they start talking up here. And then the onus is on me to suddenly try to do the translation. And it's hard to go back, you know, you can't go home again. Once they know that, it's hard for them to speak simply and easily to me again. So I sort of play this game sometimes. I try to not let people know until absolutely necessary, because I do run into those situations where you walk into the office and you can see the nervousness and anxiety in the face of the astronomer or the physicist, worried that I'm going to completely misinterpret what they're saying. And I find in the course of the conversation that that anxiety and nervousness is actually hurting the interview. Then I will sort of lay my cards out on the table. And you can visibly see they suddenly ease. Oh my gosh, she knows what a Fourier transform is. And then sometimes that can actually make for a better interview. So I decide to use that background depending on the situation I'm in, and it can change from interview to interview or story to story.
Dennis, you'll have to tell us whether you were helped.
All right, well, it is true that this is on, right? Yeah. I did major in physics at MIT. I defy anybody to look at my transcript and conclude that this was an advantage. It is an advantage, sort of, in that I feel like I can go someplace like that and blend in, and I sort of have a feel for the sociology of science. I kind of really came into journalism as a failed novelist. And it's knowing a little bit about science is kind of, it is a disadvantage, because I always have to fight the temptation to try to show off. When I'm talking to somebody, I'm smart. I know what you're talking about, right? And the conversation will quickly veer off into some level that's of no use to the reader. I'm there representing the readers of the New York Times who don't know anything about science, or my editors who are even more fearful that we're going to put something out that nobody will understand and they won't catch hell from their bosses. So I have to kind of rein myself back and try to remember to ask the obvious. Maybe I should stop there.
Well, then I'll ask you to answer the question that novice book reviewer asked about Einstein in Love. Can you appreciate the beauty of relativity without the mathematics? Or we could come back to that if you'd rather.
All right, well, actually, I have another thought here. This is sort of related to the first question, which is how is it that you can do this? And so a couple of days ago, a longtime friend of mine here sort of gently scolded me about this article that was just in the paper, because there are a couple of people quoted in it that he thinks maybe I lean on too often for quotes. The one thing you definitely need to make sense in this business is friends. You are always dependent on the kindness of strangers. And this is sort of how it works at this sausage-making end of this cultural machinery that we're engaged in here, because I'm sort of sitting at the point where science enters the culture. And at the Times, we have maybe a few hours to a few weeks to work on a story. And we pretty much do what we want, except there's the proviso that you can't miss any big news in your field, which my beat is what I like to call cosmic affairs. So what's big news? Every day I'm flooded with emails and press releases from people who want to help me find out what the big news is, public relations people, information officers, NASA, the editors of the journals. And they make everything sound like it's the biggest or the brightest or the youngest or the oldest or the closest or the farthest away or the clue to quantum gravity or the key to, you know, pocket holographic recorders or something. So, I mean, I have a network of people that I can forward these on and ask them, so what, you know, what is this? Is this really new, or didn't somebody do this a few years ago, or, you know, what am I missing here? And only after you sort of, I've gotten some sort of affirmation from somebody out there that I'm willing to commit myself to doing a story, I'll call up, you know, some poor assistant professor, or maybe at Harvard, who's never talked to the press before. But most of the scientists in the United States apparently have mothers living in Brooklyn or New Jersey who think that their kids will not be a success until their name is in the New York Times. And so now the New York Times is on the phone and they're like deer in the headlights. And you might talk to them and sort of get some understanding of sort of what happened, but you don't have that quote that's really going to bring it home to the reader that makes it friendly. And I know who to call to get those quotes, and I will call those people. And I'm always looking for more people who can do that job, but it's something, you know, we need the kindness of strangers and or friends in this case. So that's what sometimes people do show up too often in my stories, but that there's the reason is because they know how to communicate, and we know who they are, and they're willing to do it, and they're available, which is also important when it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I'll stop.
Oh, you've heard that having a science background can maybe be a mixed bag, which is a bit of a surprise, and it surprised me too. It was a mixed bag for me, and the best way I can explain that is to spend just a second telling you how I started to write science. I had just published my 100th journal article, yay, and I had a very, very good friend, a writer, who said, you know, Sidney, do you think when you die, they're going to say, he published 100 journal articles. Do you think the president of Emory, my university, will get suddenly significantly happier because you've now published your 101st journal article? So this was quite compelling stuff. It made me really rethink what I wanted to do. I'd always admired writers, actually more than scientists, because I think they have more fun. It was just that simple. When I was a kid, the writers were my heroes, not so much the scientists. So I started writing, and since I'm a physicist, of course, I brought that to what I write. And I found pluses and minuses, and I just thought I'd tell you some of each. You've heard some of the others. This is my list. One plus is knowing science is a good thing. It gives you self-confidence to write about any kind of science. I've now written about everything from physics to biomedicine to robotics. I have the confidence that I can go in and learn what I need to. When I first started writing and no one knew who the hell I was, the fact that I had a physics PhD and could apparently string four words together impressed a lot of editors. So at least I had an entree. Didn't always guarantee that the piece would get published, but they would listen to me. And one issue I haven't heard yet, those 100 journal articles really paid off in one very important way. You learn a certain style in writing science. It's a rigid style, it's a limited style, but it's a concise style. Conciseness is, of course, not the only quality or necessarily the most important quality in writing, but it's an important quality to draw on when you need it. So my writing style developed in a certain way. A couple of minuses. Dennis mentioned issues about interviewing. I find the same. When I interview a scientist, it's hard for me to keep my mouth shut. I also want to show that I'm as smart as he or she is. And yet, very often, the most important moments in interviewing come when you're quiet, not when you ask the next question. So learning to keep my mouth shut and letting the person flow out has been a little bit of a struggle for me. And finally, I have to fight the physicist's desire to explain everything. I learned this especially from playwriting, and in fact, I just wrote an article about science plays in which I put in this line, too much explanation can be the death of drama. So I work very, very hard at trying to explain just enough, but not more than that. That's my list of the ups and the downs, but I do want to answer the question, do you need science to be a great science writer? Absolutely not. Some of the best people out there do not have all that much of a science background. They bring passion to their writing, and that's really the key thing.
I think the biggest example, Richard Preston, who has a PhD in English literature, and yet wrote this beautiful book, First Light, which had both all of the literary quality of a good novel, yet got the science right. So, and beautifully done. And at a level that was very accessible to a wide audience. He he had that ability to sit quietly and listen. And that's really a large part of any type of writing, but especially in nonfiction in an interview situation, allowing that person to fully have the chance to talk out their thoughts without the interference of trying to prove you
know. You're just as smart.
I'm just as smart, which is really a temptation in this game, especially if you cover a beat, you go to a lot of conferences, you hang out, you start wanting to be one of the guys or gals, and you have to understand that is not your role. As Dennis pointed out, his clients are the readers of the New York Times. For me, it's the readers of my books and magazine articles. That's why we're there at the conference, not to make friends and impress the people we're interviewing, but to get the best information that we can convey back to our audience. And we have to keep that always central in our mind.
Well, I'll add what Casey, she would have said more than this, but with her bachelor's degree in political science from Barnard, she's often been asked by Nobel laureates in physics where she was trained in physics. Mm-hmm. And she actually thinks that she learned everything she knew from working with Phil Morrison and Vicki Weisskopf in situations when she had the opportunity to interview and write about them. Okay, well, I'm going to throw out one more question that Marcia had proposed. I mean, considering the commercial success of physicists like Hawking and Green, does the public want science straight from the source?
There, I think it was the Stephen Hawking Brief History of Time phenomenon that really started that. That was such a sensational commercial event. The fact that there was this theoretical physicist who wrote a book that sold millions around the world. And then it seemed from that moment on within the commercial publishing trade that all the publishers wanted those science books to come from the source, from the authority. And it was a little tougher for us. I don't know how Dennis or Sydney found this to, I felt a real difference in the atmosphere in the New York publishing world, that suddenly the science writer who did not have that PhD and actually worked on all those great theories, I think we had a harder time of it to try to prove our case. I think it's come back from that a little bit. I think Davis Sobel with Longitude helped us a bit. These go through pendulum swings. But certainly a Brian Greene's Elegant Universe, the Stephen Hawking phenomenon, does have an effect in the publishing world. And we have to sort of fight that and then try to build up what our strengths are. And our strengths are in the writing techniques that we are taking to the plate that a scientist may not necessarily, a scientist who is solely, doing that one book or two, but still working in the field, there's a difference. I mean, there's a reason that I'm in a science writing program because we do want to teach the techniques that would make the science story most vivid and enlightening to the reader, that the scientists may not necessarily apply to their work. Though, you know, there is this desire, I think. There's a certain segment of the reading audience, I think, who likes to feel like they're hooked into the source itself. Reading Hawking, they're going to be understanding what's in his mind. Reading Brian Greene, they're going to really find out what superstring theory is all about. They feel that there's this direct connection. And it's something I think we have to fight as being simply the science writer.
Dennis, do you have a response?
Yeah, well, one thing, I mean, anybody with experience with the publishing industry knows that nobody can predict what's going to sell. Everything is a surprise.
Yeah.
My experience of this, I mean, I agree with Marcia that Hawking's book certainly set something off. Part of it was, it was kind of sad to me that scientists with lifetime tenure and Nobel Prizes suddenly felt their lives were a tragedy if they also didn't have a $500,000 book contract. And there are many of those out there, and they didn't do very well. And my desk at the Times is overflowing with books. I mean, I get books in the mail every day from publishers, many of them by scientists, you know, from the truth from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Very few of them are going anywhere except to the giveaway table. I would say, yeah, I mean, Brian Greene is another, Brian's another phenomenon. And he's an amazing writer and an even better lecturer, and he's a cool guy. And all this, and the fact that he's in New York, all played into his success, I think. I think what these people can't do, which we can do, is that we can write about themselves and the community, and they're still practicing scientists, and so they're limited in a way by what they can say. It's a little bit like what I was talking about yesterday. There are a few people writing more franker accounts of the scientific life, but that's still a role mostly that we have to play, because we're the outsiders, and we can see in and say things that they can't out of professional plainness or whatever.
I agree. I think the scientist is held back sometimes. Anthony Zee and I were talking about this yesterday evening at dinner, about the fact that when you are immersed in your own community, you're going to hold back. You're not going to be totally honest. Though Jim Watson with the double helix gave a little away, and there are exceptions to the rule, but I think for the most part, the scientist writer is always going to sort of be the that guru on the mountain, and they're going to want to maintain that sense that they are imparting a certain knowledge, and you know the scientific enterprise is wonderful, and the science writer can sit back on the side of the room and portray what they're really observing, what they're really seeing, and report that. I think in a way that a scientist might be held back if they're still actively working within the community, and there's a concern then that their status may be affected. The Carl Sagan syndrome, where you know jealousies, envy, all of that can enter into the game, as well as if they get too honest, it might come down on them in some way in their professional credentials. So that's not a worry on my part. I worry about accuracy. That is my sole worry. I do not worry if I'm describing somebody or setting a scene. That's my business as a writer. But I will work with the scientist to maintain accuracy of the scientific facts.
Can you explain the Carl Sagan thing about jealousy?
Carl Sagan, I mean, there was, his name was brought forward to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and it was almost a done deed until there was a grassroots effort among certain people who frankly thought because of his popularizations that he wasn't worthy to be a member of the National Academy, and his nomination was withdrawn. I think that atmosphere has changed now, and I think because of the Stephen Hawking phenomenon and the Brian Greens and all of the other books that now that have come forth from scientists, I think there's less of that sense that if you write a popular book, somehow you're tainting your scientific reputation. But that was very true for Carl Sagan and you know, doing that sort of writing to reach a popular audience.
Since I have the microphone, let me add a footnote to this, that the stage was set for Hawking.
You have the microphone, please?
Pardon me?
You have the microphone, but you have not turned it on.
Oh, how do you how many spaces does it take to turn on the microphone? I'm a theorist.
It's the PA system, it's not the microphone.
Oh, it's there. Okay.
a footnote to what prepared the public for the amazing success of Hawking and Brian Greene. It happened actually in the mid-70s with the New Age consciousness movement coming out of Esalen and Big Sur, which I was very much part of. And there was a book called The Dancing Woolly Masters, which actually I think sold more, I don't know how many millions of copies it sold, and The Tao of Physics by Fritjof Capra. Both those books are kind of, you know, not kosher for the standard academic community, but they actually created the market, and it was also because of John Brockman, his kind of genius marketing ability that, so the public was already set. There was an audience out there waiting for Hawking and Greene from Zhukov's book, which I actually wrote most of the physics in it, actually. But it sold about at least 4 to 8 million copies. I don't know exactly how many copies it sold, but a lot of copies. And I think
we could have a whole discussion of whether those books helped or hurt physics, but I do not
it's a fact. I'm not saying they're
so
good
I'd
books.
Like to
I'm saying
to
it's
the
a fact.
That's
it's,
on
a,
the
it's,
table.
A, it's a marketing fact.
If I may, I'd like to respond to the question that's on the table, which is, do you have to be a physicist and, so to speak, represent data straight from the horse's mouth to win an audience? And the answer is absolutely not. There are books written by eminent physicists who have been dead as doornails, not the people, but the books. There are books written by science writers that have done fantastically well. And I just want to cut the category in a different way. The answer is, can you get inside the story or not? Some scientists can, whether it be their own stories or someone else's. Some non-scientists can. That's what Davis Sobel did with Longitude. She got inside a personal story in a way that moved people. And if you read the book, you might recall that at the very end, she herself breaks into tears when she visits the site at which Longitude happened. So she made it a very personal story that people could resonate to. The Brian Greens work well, but it's not the only way to do it well.
Tony, and then...
I actually have a number of comments to make, in particular, for example, the Tao of Physics business. As a Chinese, and I happen to know a lot about Taoism, and I happen to be a working physicist, but if I had written that book of Tao of Physics, I could not look at myself in the mirror. Right? So I'm under a lot of constraints. So, but I want to address the question to Professor Perkowitz, actually.
Sydney.
Okay. I it's a pleasure at this conference to have gotten to know him.
It's mutual.
And Professor Sydney.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Good compromise.
Okay. About 15 years ago, Phil Anderson was at the ITP visiting, and for those of you in humanities who do not know who Phil Anderson is, let me just say a few words about him. He's a Nobel laureate in physics at Princeton University, and he's generally considered as one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century, whose impact on theoretical physics has been absolutely major. And he came and lamented the fact that it's possible to write a book on condensed matter physics. And as we heard from Professor Gervin the other day, condensed matter physics is actually the largest subject in physics. But if you go to a cocktail party, 20 years ago, everybody wants to know about quarks and gluons, and nowadays, the only thing that people want to talk about is string theory. If I tell them I'm a theoretical physicist, they immediately ask me, are you a string theorist? So if you talk to them about high temperature conductivity, they say things like, would it lower my electric bill? Phil Anderson was asking me this question, and in fact, most physicists who have written popular books have written about the universe and particles and gluons and so on, gravitational wave, and then, of course, Einstein, everything regarding Einstein. So I was pleasantly surprised when I discovered that Professor Sydney is an experimental condensed matter mm-hmm. theorist. Not only experimental condensed matter physicist, not only a, usually it's also theorists who write these books. So I'm very interested in how you overcame this impossible barrier that Phil Anderson and I talked about.
Well, you raised a point I wanted to talk about, so I'm quite glad you asked. It's a fascinating paradox to me that it seems to me there are two poles in writing about physics, if not in science in general. The one pole are the grandiose ideas, the string theory, how the universe began, is the universe infinite, the questions that we all love to ask and that are not easy to answer. The other pole, however, is everyday physics. There are quite a few books that have done beautifully on such topics as the physics of baseball. I think a physics prize just went to a book called How to Dunk a Donut, which explains to you how to overcome this terrible, fateful thing that whenever you dunk a donut, a piece breaks off into the coffee. You can actually explain this through physics. And I'll be glad to reveal the secret to those who will see me privately later. I charge a small sum. I think good writing can make it happen. Thank you. Actually, I'm sorry I missed the little bit of stage business. Your cup isn't big enough. You need a large cup. I'll just give you a hint. All right, I'll tell you all. Dunk it sideways, not vertically. That's the secret. It's as simple as that. So you need a big cup. Good writing can overcome all of that. I'd mentioned earlier, good writing can overcome any of that. I mentioned in another context my book called Universal Foam, which is really about everyday physics. It doesn't tell you how to dunk a donut, but it does tell you why champagne tastes the way it does and how to make nice foamy foods like souffles. Good writing and an interest in doing it can make it happen. People should be aware that both poles can work.
I mean, what we're really talking about is there's sort of two subject areas. I mean, writing about physics, we're really talking about the grand intellectual ideas, as Sidney pointed out. How did the universe begin? Is there other life forms out there? We're talking about overwhelming ideas that I think all people from day one have had a fascination with. But as in any writer, the other segment is, yes, there's physics to describe, but you have to find that hook that would draw the person in to become connected to it. So you have this idea of the surface tension and the donut and the material science. I mean, there's all kinds of concepts wrapped up, but you put it into the context of a donut and a cup of coffee, and then suddenly, you have connected to someone's everyday world. I often envy the fact that health and medicine writers have that all the time. They always have that human connection. They always, you read any medical story in the New York Times and there'll be an opening about somebody getting cured, somebody facing a challenge. There's instantly the human connection. And that's often something that I strive for, is how can I find that link that would draw what I am trying to talk about into a human context.
I have a question about research techniques, and particularly for you guys who don't have as much of a science background. But what I found when I was doing research is I would read these books, particularly books by physicists, and I would, as I was reading them, I'd sort of realize, wait, this guy has an agenda. You know, he's pushing his own theory, and maybe there's a competing theory, but I don't even know where to look for the competing theory. You know, I don't, because the world of physics to an outsider is huge and complicated, and you know how, and the debate about what's right and wrong doesn't really take place in layman's terms in the public eye. So it's really hard to sort of parse out where to look for the sort of alternative views if you're researching a particular topic. So I was wondering if you had any sort of research tips.
The more people you talk to, the better.
Yeah.
And
it's a matter of developing a network. As Dennis mentioned, you sort of over time, as you cover a beat, I have a huge Rolodex after 20 years of covering physics and astronomy, and there are certain people that you tend who feel that they have their thumb on the pulse of what the community is thinking about. So you go to those people to say, what do you think of this new thing? How does it fit in? You call an array of people who are working in that same arena and getting the sense of, no, this is an extreme, oddball theory and it's going to go nowhere, or this is really interesting and everyone's talking about it excitedly at that conference we had last week. Then you start seeing the patterns and the trends, and that's something I'm always looking for, is looking for the patterns and the trends. I don't tend, since I tend to do magazine articles rather than daily news and books, I followed the literature. Since I had a background in physics, that's one advantage of having the degree in physics. I can regularly skim the physical review letters or the astrophysical journal. And what I'm looking for is topics that are sort of popping up over and over, but have not yet emerged. I was back in my first article on dark matter. It wasn't even called dark matter back then. It was called The Missing Mass. It was in 1982, before, you know, sometimes I can jump the gun. I'll write about something before it becomes really, really part of the news. But I'm always looking for those trends. But if you come across an idea that's really interesting, then you want to sort of break out and start contacting other people, maybe people who are mentioned at the end in the citations. And if they're referencing other people's work, call those other people, find out what they think.
I
was so pleased to hear the word accurate this morning, because I think the first thing that should be done is to get the science right, where there's a consensus among scientists. But to be, like someone said yesterday, have poetic license on the frontier of science, where imagination can play such a powerful role. But when I heard someone speak yesterday of poetic license, I became emotionally almost distraught, because I think that we misinform the public when we corrupt the science in order to attract attention or even for commercial gain. And that's the problem with these zingers that we have. we keep looking for zingers, you know, quotable quotes, which can emphasize the wrong thing quite often in order to attract attention. And I see that, I'm sorry, Mr. Overby, I even see that on Tuesdays occasionally.
Whoa.
He's distraught now.
It's this zinger complex that we have all gotten into, because we know that's what the people want to hear about. But is that really the right way to communicate science? Maybe you want to discuss this, maybe you don't. I'm a little emotional about it, which is very bad.
I think it's a central.
We all do.
I think it's a central part is that we're fighting this constantly, because each one of the scientists and writers in this room have a different level of what they're comfortable with in the way they handle certain metaphors and analogies. And what one person, one scientist, may be perfectly comfortable with a certain analogy, and I've had this happen where I'll go to another scientist and they'll like pull their hair out and say, no, 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 you can't say that. I've just fought this. I have a National Geographic article coming out in May, and it's on Einstein's legacy to astronomy. And it is for a lay audience, so I use some metaphors and analogies, and they had two different scientists check this story out. One was perfectly comfortable with certain phrases I used, and another was livid that, oh my gosh, this is wrong. And what it got down to, it's not that it was wrong, it was, what is your comfort level for explaining something? I had this happen recently with a student. The assignment was to explain Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And there was a woman in the class who did this beautiful job describing it. She had no background in science, in physics. Her background was in biology. But she did a beautiful job explaining it. And another student who did have an undergraduate degree in physics was livid, because she was using the fact that you couldn't know at the very same time exactly velocity and position. The woman had said velocity, and the physics student said, no, 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 you can't say that, it's momentum. And I said, calm down, calm down. Velocity is fine for a general audience. No, that's wrong. And I think that should be downgraded. So we have this, even within the class, in my science writing class, you're finding people have this different level. And so sometimes it can be a relative situation, depending on who you're talking to, as to how you're going to deal.
Another piece to the answer, and I'd like to hear both of my colleagues comment on it. Many science writers and journalists will say, the scientists themselves have gotten so good at knowing how to manipulate the media, and this is perhaps truer in the biomedical end than the physics end, that the zingers come from the scientists. The scientists know what it means to appear in the New York Times even before a journal article appears. So this is a complicated question, and if you think the issue of accuracy lies just with these guys, that's incomplete. It lies with the scientists too.
It's not restricted to the medical.
And not restricted.
It's sort of a comment that I think you can use the uncertainty principle a little bit in science writing. In other words, you're playing clarity versus accuracy. And in some sense, the more accurate you are, the less clear it is to most of the audience, and the more clear you are, the less accurate. And I think a lot of scientists feel that pressure because if they're very accurate, no one knows what they're talking about. If they're very clear, their colleagues give it to them. Mm-hmm. So that's a certainty principle working very well in writing.
That's great.
The American Physical Society tried for its centennial a year beforehand to reach the press. And so they decided to try an experiment with a very expensive public relations company to pick three stories and to see whether the press would buy any of them, and I mean the press by that radio, TV, the whole press. And the three stories they chose were something on lasers, another thing on molecular like slicing, and the third was the physics of traffic. Okay. 99% of the audience wanted the physics of traffic. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, there was not even close. I mean, you know, just and since I was doing the physics of traffic, I had you know many interviews. Every city was interested in it, but you had to sell it in a very special way. You had to say, like, how come when you build a fourth lane to a highway, within 2 weeks that highway is jammed? You know, and then we invented the traffic sort of periscope. What happens was, and it had to be very sexy, what happens is whenever you listen to the radio, they're telling you about traffic not where you are, they're telling you someplace else. And what you want to hear is the traffic where you are. And so the idea of a periscope was that you can see ahead 5 miles from where you are. And there were just a lot of ideas. In New York, we have always the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, and the George Washington Bridge. Well, if somebody says the Holland Tunnel is crowded and the Lincoln Tunnel is crowded, try the George Washington Bridge. Within 10 minutes, you can't get over the George Washington Bridge. So, you know, the idea behind that is with satellites and others, you give everybody different information depending upon the patterns and other things that go. So there are ways of dealing with it, but there is a lot of physics there. So yeah, I think there are topics, and I'm wondering...
You're showing the power of everyday physics again.
But, exactly. It still doesn't answer the question, I think, that Tony said, which is when you ask what's inside, which is the edge of the universe, or what's on beyond, everyone loves that.
Right.
But we have to do, as you did, the physics of foam, you're doing beer. Everybody loves beer.
Everyone loves beer.
The physics of things moving, everyone loves baseball. I'm saying, but we can say, I'm going to talk to you about the miracle of the transistor. The closest we came in some ways is Glick's book on chaos. Fractals seems to sell. Some complexity seems to sell. And now they're trying, as I said before, the word emergence. They're trying to sell that as something. So it needs a sexy angle, whereas cosmology doesn't. Particle physics at the very inside doesn't need it. So we still have a problem.
It's a mystery, yes.
I think condensed matter physics needs a new name.
Well, let's call it string theory. String theory.
We have a question here, and then I'm going to ask the final question to the committee.
I think there's a reason to have science writers to deal with big science. You look at articles on particle physics, and there can be 80 signatures to the article.
No, 500.
So it's nice to have somebody stand in for 70 people and simplify it. But another angle, too, in big science, I don't think Carlo Rubbia would have ever written Nobel Dreams, if you're familiar with that book. It's a very hard look at high energy physics and the amount of money and the personalities and so forth. I think it's a wonderful book, and I doubt if any physicist would have ever written it.
Is that the book by Michael Reardon?
No, it's the book by Gary Taubes.
Gary Taubes, okay.
Yeah.
He was an old colleague of ours from the Discover magazine.
We're almost running out of time, I'm sorry to say. And so I'm going to ask one more question, and then we can ask the panel, and I suppose we can continue to talk about this over coffee. Marcia You said that scientists, as opposed to science writers, are limited in what they can say about the scientific community. And of course, the first thing that popped into my head was that when in your book, Einstein's Unfinished Symphony, the gravity waves, I learned as much about pork science and why almost all those gravity wave installations, all of them are in particular states, as I did about gravity waves. What do you think of that? I mean, are science writers in some way, can they counter the, are they not apologists for science, not publicists for the science, or they do something different? They have a kind of critical, take a kind of critical look at science in a way that scientists wouldn't.
Definitely, I think that's part of my mandate. I don't want to be the cheerleader for science, though I have the background, and I certainly, as you read my book, you see I'm caught up in the endeavor. One of the things that drew me to this topic, this book involves the trying to detect the last prediction from Einstein's theory of general relativity, which has to do with vibrations, actual vibrations in space-time, called gravity waves. You can think of them as cosmic quakes. And I was very caught up in the fact that I had thought over the years that I had missed all the great moments of the founding of various fields, radio astronomy, X-ray astronomy, gamma ray. You know, I was, you know, just coming up, coming into the to astronomy writing to clean up the details. I missed those great moments that I always admired. Walter Sullivan, the old New York Times reporter who reported on when all of these new fields of astronomy and physics were opening up. And when I found out about this endeavor, that they were going to try to build these observatories, I said, great, I can get in on the ground floor. That was one of my interests in doing this book, to be there as they were trying to get this up. But it was a highly controversial endeavor. Took 10 years of fighting, fights within the astronomical community and the physicists, 10 years of fighting to get the funding in Congress, and I covered that also. Covered and showed why people were against it, why people were for it, and that's part of the story. It's not my job to try to make this happen, but to report on what happened. And that's what I attempted to do. And I think by being the outsider, by being the reporter, by being the science writer, I had that freedom. And the scientists I was interviewing knew that I wasn't there to act as their publicist. And I asked the hard questions, and hopefully I got some of that into the book.
Dennis, have you felt yourself in that role?
Well, it is true that as a science writer, you are sort of perceived and even welcomed by the scientific community as their friend. And you have to sort of disabuse them of that a little bit. It's because you're not really there for them. You are there for the reader, for the New York Times. And it was like Lester Bangs says in that movie about the young rock writer, you know, just because you can hang out with the band, but you'll never be cool.
Cindy, can you be cool?
Yeah, I'll try. I've just asked, can I be cool? I'll do my best, but I will be brief, I guarantee that. Look, I have tenure. I can write whatever the hell I want to about science. I also have a lot of inside information about scientific culture, which is often more interesting than the science itself. My most popular pieces have been about why scientists dress so badly, and physicists lead the pack, I'm sorry to say, in bad dressing. I wrote a piece about the kind of personal ads scientists would write for each other, which I found hilarious, and a lot of other people did. So you get a certain amount of insight as an insider, and since I do have and since I'm not committed to any particular scientific community anymore, since I do have tenure, I don't feel any limitations on what I write. I can make fun of scientists, and I like to do it.
Tony, we'll give you Tony, and then in the back, yeah. Question.
I want to ask you a question about the harm science writers can do.
We knew that was coming.
When the so-called hydrogen economy first came out, of course, the New York Times, and of course it's by far by I was going to say by a quantum jump. Of course, that's a misuse of the word quantum jumps, because quantum jumps are very small.
Not very large.
But the writer who wrote, I'm sure you know who he is, really either seemed oblivious of or didn't want to talk about the fact that hydrogen is not a source of energy. That hydrogen, I know hydrogen wells, but that hydrogen has to be made with a great input of energy. In general, with the second law, you have to put more energy in than you get out when you degrade it. Whereas, of course, hydrogen can be good for minimizing pollution and so on. He got that completely wrong, and for a long time, the Times got it wrong, and the editorialists got it wrong. And that may have a political effect, actually, in terms of pushing something over expectations for the public, not realizing that basically energy has to come from bound states. So how does one deal with that? I'm sure you knew that was wrong. Did you go to the writer and say you didn't?
No, I don't remember who wrote about that. Probably Matthew Wald, who covers the Department of Energy. Did you ever talk to the Times about this?
I wrote a long letter, but it got so intemperate that it never sent it.
That's a whole other.
Yeah, we can have a whole panel there.
We have Tony.
I wanted to go back to something that the panelists said earlier, which is this issue of being inside a community and outside a community. And I have experience with both, actually. Since I'm a physicist, when I write my physics books, actually, I take the opposite extreme, which is that I actually refrain from interviewing anyone, any of the physicists involved, and talking to any of them, and just put in my take of what happened, because I don't want to be influenced by their ego and so on and so forth, by their hubris about what they discovered and how they discovered and how brilliant they are and so on. But on the other hand, as some of you know, after writing two popular books on physics, I got so sick of writing about physics that I went out and wrote a book about the food, culture, and language of China called Swallowing Clouds, which was a great success, and it was really great because took me outside the physics community completely. And but there, obviously, I was an outsider. And then I have to interview or communicate with some of the great scholars in this field, like Casey Chan at Harvard and Ian Anderson at the University of California. These people are academics who made their lifetime scholarly study of Chinese food. But then this question of credentials come up, because after that, I had a sabbatical in France, and while I was doing my physics research, I took a lot of notes on the food I was eating, and I wanted to write a book on the food culture and language of France to follow my book about Chinese food. And it was amazing. The publishers all said, what are your credentials? So apparently the fact that I'm Chinese is enough for my first book. But the fact and they even said, we'll publish the book if you're willing to change your name to some French name.
Why didn't you?
Why didn't
See, sounds like it sounds like you've lived a tragic life.
I want to be the panelists about this inside, outside.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the panel, and thanks very much for participating and asking good questions.